Welcome to After Cana, a Fairest Love podcast dedicated to exploring the vocation of marriage. In each episode, we bring you stories, advice, and insights from experts and seasoned couples to help guide you in your journey, whether you're dating, engaged, or newly married. I'm your host, Emily, and today we are bringing back Father Paul Donlan to speak about qualities to look for in a future wife. Very excited to continue this conversation with Father Paul. And if you haven't already listened to part one of this two-part episode series, you can find the link in the description. And that is on qualities to look for in a future husband. For those who are new, Father Paul will be drawing from his wisdom as a priest of 63 years, having worked with single young adults, engaged couples, preparing them for marriage, and then giving spiritual direction to married men and women. He has so much wisdom to share with us. So let's just get right into it.
Great. Okay. Well, we are back with Father Paul Donlan, and we are going to get into the qualities to look for in a future wife. Welcome back.
Thank you. Do you need to make any further comment before I begin to speak, Emily?
Let's dive right in.
Okay. Well, again, I would say the first feature, the first characteristic I would look for, suggest that a man look for in a girl that he's thinking of marrying, somehow or other, she is or has a capacity to be, quote, motherly. That she's oriented, in general, she is oriented towards life. And she wants to be a mother. She sees being a mother as the greatest thing there could be. She may be a heart surgeon or studying medicine now to become a heart surgeon. But deep down, she has a yearning to be a mother. I deal with women of all sorts, backgrounds, and people who've been actresses, singers, dancers, and physicians, and what have you, who are women, well-qualified, full-time working, and they are willing to surrender it completely just to be a full-time mother or part-time worker to be a full-time mother. By the way, interesting thing is that in this workaday world, at least so far, it's almost impossible for a man to be working part-time. It's very feasible for a woman who has already achieved a certain effectiveness in a professional career to be working part-time, 2 days a week, 3 days a week, two half days, working from home. Women have an advantage there in a way. They can keep their finger in the pie of professional life and same time be home if they have children, of course. But the idea of oriented towards that, and that would indicate also a second point, that they are focused on others in a generic way. They are givers. They are generous givers. I think this is innate in every woman of whatever age, but it can be stifled because of the culture, because of whatever, because of just an increased amount of self-centeredness within them, or because of bad formation. But I think that it's innate and it's something to be fostered, to be a generous giver. I love that phrase of St. Paul in the letter to Philippians, not mistaken, God loves a cheerful giver for everyone, especially a woman.
I've heard it said that like men are givers, women are receivers. Could you go into sort of like what you mean in terms of like femininity and generosity of, or?
Well, I would say, I mean, I don't quite agree with that dichotomy. I think it's a dichotomy. Men are givers, women are receivers. It's like, I think men are meant to be givers and to be receivers. And women are meant to be givers and meant to be receivers. But there's a kind of spontaneity of giving in women that you don't easily find in men. They're more given to giving. And that leads to another thing, which is the capacity of compassion. Compassion and tenderness. By the way, notice that in the interview regarding what a woman should look for in a husband, the first thing I pointed to was being a gentle man with Jesus as model. I would say here, very fitting, Mary of Nazareth, Mary the mother of Jesus, Mary the mother of God, is a fitting model for every woman at any age. And we find in her the fulfillment of the meaning of the word compassion. See, passion means suffering. So that as we speak of the passion of the Christ, the suffering of Christ, well, Mary is at the foot of the cross, suffering vicariously that which she suffers. She's suffering in her heart, already fulfilling the prophecy of Simeon. Your own soul a sword shall pierce. And so it's fulfilled literally in that moment. As the side of Christ is pierced by the spear, her own soul is pierced. She is experiencing compassion, which means from the Latin word cum, with, and pastio, suffering. She's suffering with Christ. And that's the model, I think, of womanhood in a way. Women have a capacity that men do not have, of compassion, of suffering with others. Men have it, but they don't have it the way a woman has it or can have it. By the way, for a man to grow up with compassion, he needs a mother who teaches him compassion. Because we tend to be brutes. The male species tend to be brutish. You know, we're animals in a way, and we're rough. We need to be tamed, and mothers tame us. A good mother. So the compassion is a big thing. Tender compassion. There's a tender touch to it. There's something very special about the tender compassion of a woman at any age. Because sometimes you can see it at a very young age of a young girl, that how they grow into that more and more. Doesn't mean that they're pushovers at all. No. Mm-hmm. It's not about the idea that they see real suffering and they're there. That's why women make such great nurses. I've been in hospitals many, many times. Many times. I've had many surgeries, many stays in hospitals, and I've been attended to by male nurses and female nurses. And the male nurses are very efficient. They're trained, they do the job very well, and they're good. But you can't beat a woman nurse at any age. They're just amazing. There's something special about them. I have such vivid experiences with women nurses. We just have that extra touch, you know? I always tell them, you know, doctors cure, but you nurses heal. You heal.
Wow, yeah.
And that is the mother, when the kid comes running in, the four-year-old, he's fallen down, he's cut his knee, he's bleeding, and he's crying. And the mother says, okay, come here, honey. And then she takes the kid, and she cleans the wound, and the kid cries because it hurts, and she bandages it with tenderness, gives him a hug and a kiss, and says, okay, now go back out and play again. That kind of, you know, it's just so. I mean, they can do the same thing, but it's different. When it comes to a mother, when it comes to a woman, there's something so special. You know, an interesting thing, oftentimes on the battlefield, when young men make great soldiers in combat because they're reckless and they think of themselves as being immortal all the time, that oftentimes when they're mortally wounded, they're dying. They always cry out for their mothers.
Wow.
And the beachheads and the jungles and the deserts, mama, they cry out. The 18, 19-year-old kid, they cry out for their mothers. It's so deeply rooted in us to have that tie to our mothers. Think, and here's another, this is a big one, point number four, domesticity, if I can use that noun, that they have a domestic quality. First of all, they desire to create a home. They look forward to creating a warm, beautiful, hospitable home. By the way, interesting thing is that a man decorates his office, if he has an office, and he finds, okay, he gets a plastic plant, a nice, beautiful green plant, looks very real, puts it in the corner, that's it, forgets about it. A woman doesn't do that. She has real plants. She comes every day, waters them, she looks at them and talks to them. I mean, she's raising life. It's interesting. I've not known any woman who puts plastic plants, artificial plants, in their home or in their apartment. Do you?
Well,
no.
I mean, I don't have plants because I'm, you know, I'm everywhere. I don't have time to come and water plants.
That's different. No, but you would. You would. I remember my mother, as soon as we had a home, right away she started planting flowers.
Yes, as soon as I have one. As soon as I have a home.
Any kind of a stable place. But the idea of creating a warm, beautiful, hospitable home. And women, a young woman, even, for example, in college, even their dormitory, perhaps, or the first apartment they may share with two other women who are now all of them working in some place rather than a city, typically after college. They try to have that warm, beautiful, hospitable. They even will invite people over for dinner or lunch or something. The idea of inviting people in. And this thing is cooking, preparing meals for others, enjoying having people over, even though it requires an awful lot of work. You shop, you cook, you present, all of that. You know, the table setting, the candles, whatever it may be, and a special menu, special wine, that kind of thing that they do. So this is something that women are oriented to. Was a guy will say to a guy, hey, let's go to In-N-Out Burger and have a burger. That's just hospitality, you know? Usually. That's just, you know, it's not very refined. Mm-hmm. So women are oriented towards home, or should be, domesticity. Now, this, by the way, is almost a lost talent. In my observation, I am struck by and chagrined by the lack of domesticity among young women. And I realize their mothers have not taught them how to be
very true
homemakers. Have you noticed that?
Of course. I am so grateful to Westfield residents for teaching me what I know about domesticity.
Yeah. And the culture is also against it. It's like it's demeaning. Because the whole lie has been, you know, this is not, you are just like a man. You could do what he does, they do even better. So be that, as opposed to, that's not really what's inside you. It isn't at all demeaning. On the contrary, it's ennobling. It's a beautiful thing to create a home and to learn how to cook and to perfect it. Because this, again, it goes back to what I said earlier about the spirit of service. How do we serve people? One way is food. Food is a very good way of serving, and the home. I mean, it's interesting when I notice oftentimes a couple reach a point where they, a married couple, they're going to buy a home, to buy a house, to make it a home. And then the first thing the man looks at is, have they had a termite inspection? How is the electric wiring? Is the gas line? Does the roof leak? You know, is the foundation solid? A woman never asks those questions. You never think of them, usually, unless she happens to be an engineer, architect of some sort. But she first thing she looks at is the kitchen. The first thing she looks at in the house about the house, then she'll say to the guy, to her husband, well, we'll have to change this kitchen. Every woman changes the kitchen automatically. First thing they do is remodel the kitchen. That's the first thing she does. Second thing, bathrooms. She looks at the kitchen, then the bathrooms. And the guy, you know, is, what's wrong with the kitchen? No, but it's not going to work. She has in mind how it's supposed to work. You'll see, if you haven't seen this, you will see this.
Yeah. The layout really does matter in terms of hosting, you know?
Well, yeah, exactly. See, it's the kitchen of a married woman is extension of herself, in part, not completely, right? So that shows the orientation that we naturally have towards the domus. Domus, the root of domestic is domus in Latin, which means house.
Mm-hmm.
Home, really home. And the difference between a house and a home is people in it. Whenever I do a blessing of a house, a blessing of a home, when a family just moved in, I tell them, one thing is the house, the other is the home. The home is the house with people in it. And so the blessing that the church has is the blessing of the people in the home, in the house. It's the whole thing, the combo. Fifth point, and this is very important for Catholic young women, piety. In the basic sense of piety, truly prayerful, pious. What I mean by that is not that she necessarily does a lot of things, like she even goes to daily mass, or she prays the rosary every day, she reads the scriptures, but she desires to grow in this personal relationship with Jesus Christ, person to person, and with Mary, the mother of Jesus. Those two things I would look for in every young woman who claims to be Catholic. Do you sense. You love Jesus. Love him. Like Mary Magdalene. Like Mary Magdalene loving Jesus. Weeping at the tomb. Can't even take her eyes off the empty tomb. I need to find him. She's mad. She's crazy with love for Jesus. That is a woman. Mary Magdalene is a great example of that. And then a relationship with the Mother Mary. Notice that the women of the Gospels that I mentioned, especially in the Gospel of St. Luke, who emphasizes the role of women, they all gather around Mary, the mother of Jesus. There's this wonderful gathering around Mary. So there's a relationship between every woman, every Christian woman, every Catholic woman, usually, and Mary, the mother of Jesus, who then leads each person into a deeper relationship with Jesus himself. But there's this love of Jesus. One of the things that frightens me also in recent decades, I've noticed among boys that I deal with, they love to pray the rosary. They will accept the invitation easily. It's very easy to lead them into devotion to Mary. Girls, oftentimes, raised Catholics, back off. They don't want to do it. They don't want to be close to her. It's scary. Wow. Have you noticed that at all?
Yeah, I don't know what it is.
It's frightening. To me, it's frightening. I remember when I was a young priest, I was a Newman chaplain back in New York City, 60s, all throughout that crazy time from 1964 to 1970. And it was dealing with two campuses of the City University of New York, day sessions and evening sessions. It was a commuter school. The kids lived at home in Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan, the Bronx, and they would come in. One campus was in the Bronx, the other was in Manhattan, Upper East Side. And it was co-ed in one place, co-ed in both places, about 50-50 in the Bronx campus, and the Manhattan campus was way more women than young men, about 20% guys and about 80% girls. In any case, all those girls coming from Catholic background, some with Italian background, Irish background, Polish background, even Middle Eastern background, the devotion they had, the piety they had from their families and from the schooling they had towards Jesus and Mary was so noticeable. They had deep connection to the Blessed Mother and deep connection to Jesus. And all of a sudden, this is, I'm talking the 1960s into just the turn of the decade to the 1970s, I began seeing this fading and fading and fading a little bit. Slowly.
You know,
it's I don't know if my observation is correct or incorrect.
I think so. I think that in a way, I know that in myself, my relationship with Our Lady deepens when I'm going through hard times, suffering, united to the cross, like really needing to like lean on her and her capacity for compassion. I wonder too, like the maturity of a young woman having to come to terms with the suffering in her own life would also grow her relationship with Our Lady in a way that isn't really intuitive.
Okay, good. That's a very good point. It's a very good point. God willing, eventually they'll come back, because as I tell young people, sooner or later you hit the wall.
Yeah. Yes.
You hit the wall of life. Something bad happens.
It's
in
true,
life.
Yeah.
And it could be a breakup, a relationship that leads you to deep distress, even depression for a period of time, failure of schooling or job, whatever it may be, or some terrible physical illness. So you hit the wall. I tell this to guys as well as girls. Sooner or later, you're going to hit the wall. And that moment, here's where suddenly you realize, I am not immortal. I'm not invulnerable. I am very fragile. And God, I have to turn to God to get me out of this and get me back on track and to make this into something good. So everything bad can become a moment to deepen ourselves in wisdom, learning, understanding, and love, and ultimately love of others. People who suffer and see the suffering in relation to Jesus become servants of others more and more. Mm-hmm. They're oriented towards giving and loving others more. Of course, the problem is when you hit the wall, you can also turn against God. So it's either or, either closer to him or further away from him. I always tell people, three questions you ask yourself. Why me? Why this? Why now? Well, God says, why not you? Why not this? Why not now?
Yeah.
Anyway, piety is real persons. Six, although I do think it's very important for a woman to have that sensitivity and that tenderness and compassion, there's something else that a woman has to have, and that is deep fortitude, toughness, toughness.
Yeah.
They can handle hardship and handle pain. And women have a capacity for pain, hardship, and suffering that a man can never reach. And but oftentimes,
wow, never.
They don't reach down inside and pull it up. The circumstances will force that. A miscarriage, a stillborn baby, a baby with defects, born with some birth defects, that and then changes entirely the whole course of their married life as a mother. No one knows. I mean, when you stand before the altar of God as a young couple marrying, you have no idea what the future holds. But a woman has to be ready for anything. And sometimes it's a move. The husband comes home from work and says, good news, bad news. What's that, honey? Good news, I've got a promotion. It will mean $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 more dollars a year. Oh, it's great news. What's the bad news? We have to move to Tennessee. The promotion, I have to move. I'm going to run the office of this law firm in Tennessee. But I don't want to leave California. The kids are in school, et cetera, et cetera. He says, I got to go. By the way, I always tell couples that are preparing for marriage, basically, the rule of thumb for you, the guy, do whatever she says. Whatever she says, you follow. But you have five or six silver bullets, and the time will come when you're going to shoot one or two. And in that case, I got the promotion in Tennessee. She says, no. He says, silver bullet, we're going. The kids will adjust. I cannot not take this job. And she says, hard, but I'll do it. I'm a pioneer woman. The pioneer woman, you know what I mean? That model of the pioneer woman who can live in a ranchhackle, homemade cabin on the frontier without heat. And make it go. You know what I mean? That kind of the woman that made this country, really, especially in the frontier, westward movement. So that kind of spirit is very important for a woman. And a guy is going to find that in a woman. She's got the resilience that she, you know, she's not just dissolved in tears all the time for whatever little thing happens. Although women naturally are going to be dissolved in tears for a little thing that happens. But there's something deeper in them. And oftentimes, the guy sees it in the mother. That's why, if a guy is smart, as soon as he's interested in the girl, he says, I want to meet your mother. I want to meet your mother and father. Because then he sees the girl now in the image of her mother and her father. So that gives him a sense of where she comes from. Because there's something there just passed on, almost genetically at times. So tough, tough. Mary, the mother of Jesus, you cannot find a more compassionate person, more tender person, and a stronger person. Tough, tough, tough. She's tough. She handled all the things. The birth in Bethlehem, the flight to Egypt, the return to Nazareth, Lord's, the death of Joseph, which we don't know about, and then the public life of Jesus in the background, finally, all the horror of the passion, the death, the burial. She goes through all of that as a model. Finally, point seven, that she, the woman that the guys look into, she understands, God willing, what he understands. Marriage is a mission given to them from God. You're on a mission from God. This is very important. By the way, I mean this a little bit as a gentle criticism of the catechesis of the past decades. I don't mean just the recent decades, post-Vatican II. I mean, for decades and decades and decades and decades, people never were prepared for marriage with the word mission as a predominant note. And I think this is a fundamental omission. The word mission is critical. That you're not just married because I love him, I love her. Together, we're going to be happy. And we're even going to raise a good family, even going to raise a large good family. It's wonderful. But it's, the whole thing is oriented towards being part of the great command, the great universal mandate of Jesus Christ, go into the whole world, make disciples of all nations. That's the mission. That's the mission. What we call the universal mandate, and evangelicals call the Great Commission. The Great Commission. And it's evangelizing. So that from the marriage, the family, from the home, there's this radiation of love of God and in the Catholic context of joy, of normality, hospitality, and serving, et cetera, et cetera. And of difficulties, pain and suffering, all part of it. But just you're on a mission from God. That's, I always want to say that to every couple when they stand before the altar. You are now entering into a new mission. You were born for this. You were created for this. And now you have the grace of God to accompany you along this path of a mission. And that mission is the same mission that Christ gave the apostles. It's the mission of the whole church. People of God, lay people, priests, bishops, everybody.
Yeah, thank you for sharing those. I'm curious, because I always love hearing stories about your own mother. Can you give us some of your favorite examples of these characteristics in her?
My mother was one tough lady. She was tough. She had five boys and two girls. I think she was meant to be a boy mother more than a girl mother. But she raised us toughly. She demanded of us a lot. No ifs and buts. Give an example. A senior in high school, senior in high school, spring break, 1 week off. And I come home and it's March, spring break, March, where I usually work as a golf course. This is Northeast. This is Boston. The golf course is closed still. It's still winter. Spring break, but still winter. The golf course hasn't opened yet. So I can't go to work there. I do work at Harvard Medical School cleaning test tubes and so forth. I just do that one day. I used to do it after school every day. I could do one day to meet that demand. But I have a whole week now. So I'm gonna have fun. I'm gonna kick back and relax. It's a senior year. The second part of my senior year. I've already got my application to call. I already know where I'm gonna go to college. I know I'm gonna be accepted. I haven't officially been accepted, but I know. So I have this carefree attitude. I walk into the house. My mother says, "Don't make any plans for this week, Paul. You're going to paint my pantry." Here I am, a senior in high school, and my jaw dropped. I said, "Oh, come on, Mom. This is spring break. I need a break. You are going to paint my pantry." One sentence. "Mom, please, come on." I argue with it. "You're going to paint my pantry. Get going." I painted a pantry, two coats. It took me all week. That was the end of my spring break rest. That was the way my mother was. She was tough. I could never say no to her. I could never say no to her. I don't know the way she was. If she said that, I would do it. But I fought with her on that one. But she was tough. She demanded, but she was also sweet. She was tender and sweet at the same time, and she was one tough lady. She was tough on herself. My mother washed clothes with the washboard and a soapstone sink in the basement, sheets and all, for nine people, self included, for years. Hanging them out in a clothesline in the backyard. We didn't have a clothes washer or dryer. It's very primitive. And she'd hang them up in the middle of winter, it's out there, and they come up stiff as ice, you know, afterwards. She was just one hard worker. Her house was impeccable. Her meals were awesome. She was a great cook, Italian, and the Italian cuisine. So it was really great, and it was wonderful. But as a result, though, she was full of wisdom. My mother's full of wisdom. And she passed on so many good things to me. She was intuitive, very, very intuitive person. She had uncanny intuitions for things and the beautiful stories I have, by the way.
I love it.
She was tough, tough, demanding on boys and my sisters and on all my brothers and me in a good way.
Yeah.
And I remember it's about the pots and the pans. You know, a good cook cleans up after himself.
Yes. For both of your parents, and we can always add if you have any anecdotes about your dad to the other podcast, but for both of them, how did they inspire and invite you into their own spiritual life as parents?
I remember one time, my mother, my parents' bedroom was off limits. So the door was closed, you didn't walk in. And usually you didn't knock either, you didn't disturb. So otherwise, other than that, the door would be open. Mother, for whatever reason. One time, I came home from school, and I wanted to share something with my mother right away. I was maybe 13 years old, and I ran upstairs, second floor, where the bedroom was, my parents' bedroom. Door was closed, and I opened it without knocking. My mother was kneeling down on the floor, praying, her hands folded, the side of the bed, her eyes closed, in deep, deep concentration of prayer. I just stood there at the doorway, shocked because I had disturbed her prayer. And very gently, she looked at me like this. She turned and said, "What is it, Paul?" Very soft voice. "What is it, Paul?" I said, "I'm sorry, Mom." And I just walked out, closed the door. So she was praying. I caught her. I caught her. My mother's piety was hidden, very personal, very quiet. So she had a deep prayer life, deep faith. That one time said everything to me. She loved God. She loved Jesus. She loved the church. She loved the Mass. She loved Holy Communion. She loved the Blessed Mother. My father was meditative. Every day he read and meditated with the Imitation of Christ book. I have his copy. And he read and meditated another book, which was on Abandonment to Divine Providence, very famous classic. Mm-hmm. Spiritual reading, mm-hmm. Father Nick Cossard, a Jesuit French priest. And those were his two books, meditating. He read everything that G.K. Chesterton wrote in a complete library of Chesterton and a complete library of Fulton Sheen. So he fed me paragraphs all the time. We were a family of readers and conversationalists. So oftentimes after finishing homework, we would be sitting in the living room quietly reading. My brothers, myself, we did. My father began reading in his chair, his favorite chair, smoke his pipe and reading. And this time he'd say, "Paul, listen to this." And he'd read a paragraph from Chesterton, a paragraph from Sheen. He said, "What do you think of that?" And I was honest, I didn't know what to think. And then he kind of explained it that he was teaching me, as I mentioned, teaching me the wisdom of wisdom of this great man, Chesterton. And so forth. So I was reared in that kind of, it wasn't like he was in a formal way teaching. It was just, he felt the inspiration to share something. He was sharing. He always shared things. My mother shared things also. But the idea of conversing. My father oftentimes would ask questions. My mother listened a great deal. She listened to him, and because she learned a lot from him. He was very wise, very learned in many ways. Never went to college. It was a self-taught individual. But I always recognized that he had wisdom. He had wisdom. And he always said, "You know, I'm a very stupid man. I don't really know a lot." And I said, "Well, you know a lot." I always thought that he did. And my mother said, Walter, you know a lot." He was full of compliments to her. She was full of admiration for him. It was a mutual admiration.
That also tells me that he had a lot of humility to say that he doesn't know anything. You know what I mean? A very humble man.
Well, no, he was. He was truly a truthful individual, and humility is the truth. So I appreciated that. And my mother demanded that we perform, that we do what we're supposed to do. We all did as a result. She didn't have to exercise more authority than that. Rare. I don't think, I can't remember my mother shouting at us. I can't remember my mother raising a voice. It was always firm, but like that one, you're going to paint my pantry. This week, you're going to paint my pantry. This week, you're going to paint my pantry. This week, you're going to paint my pantry. Okay, Mo, okay, Mo. It's the firmness of it, you know. And
yeah.
But at the same time, there was a beautiful, if I may tell the story, when I was senior in high school, between my senior high school and my freshman college, that summer, after a hard summer of a lot of work, I went with a cousin of mine. We used to work together. We were almost the same age. And another friend of his, two friends of his, actually, we drove up to New Hampshire to a resort beach town called Hampton Beach, New Hampshire, post Labor Day weekend, when all the resorts have closed down. Everything was between Memorial Day weekend and Labor Day weekend, September, first weekend, September. We went up there at the end of the summer, after Labor Day weekend, before we started school again, to rest. We literally were tired. We were all hard workers of different types. And with our money, we rented a cabin for the weekend. Prices dropped. It was ready. And we bought beer and sandwiches and all kind of things. There was a band playing in a kind of a dance hall, open dance hall, that was still there. They hadn't packed themselves up and left. They were playing there all summer long. The summer was running. They were still there. So we went there. This was like a Saturday night. Went there on a Saturday night. And lo and behold, there were a couple of girls there who were nice-looking girls. So we became friends with them, all four of us, the two of them. And then kind of, you know, we started dancing and this kind of thing. And then I kind of paired off with one of them who was, I just found her very attractive. She seemed to be drawn to me. So then at the end of the weekend, we dealt with each other in several days together. And did different things, and all clean things, believe me, nothing at all impure. And then I invited her to come down to Boston if she had time to visit Boston. And I show her around, and she could stay with my family. I didn't check with my family. I just said, you can stay with us. I know the hospital will accept it. So she agreed to do that. So lo and behold, I came back to Boston. And then a couple of days later, she came down. She lived in Canada. She was from Nova Scotia. Two of them were from Nova Scotia. And so she came down on train, and I picked her up at the train station, brought her home, addressed to my parents. And she stayed in my sister's bedrooms. Two girls were together. So they put a third bed there, and she stayed there several days. And I spent time with her when I wasn't working. I was working still at the golf course. I had a big job there at the golf course. I was caddy master. And then we went to Mass on Sunday together. Things like she's Catholic. And so we talked and talked and talked. We spent a lot of time together. And then she's had to leave. She had to go back because her father was widowed and needed her. And so she was the only child. So she went back to Nova Scotia. And before she left, I said, you know, I want to marry you.
Whoa.
And she said, that won't work. That won't work. She said, I love you very much, Paul, but this won't work. She was wiser than I was. She was actually a year older than me. I was 17 at the time. She was 18 or 19. But she said, it won't work because I don't have that freedom and so forth. And there were two different countries and all that. She understood. And I said, okay. She said, it was so sweet. And so it wasn't a rejection of me. It was just acknowledgement of a reality. And that was it was painful, though. So we kissed goodbye, and that was it. Brought her to the train station. She went back up to Canada. Then we wrote back and forth a number of times, corresponded. In those days, you wrote letters. And one day after that, I was with my mother in the kitchen. She was preparing dinner. I would have conversations with my mother like 5 o'clock, 5:30 in the afternoon. She was preparing the evening meal in the kitchen. And we're talking. And my mother looked at me and said, I forgot the girl's name momentarily. I know. She said, you fell in love with her, didn't you? She said very sweetly, it wasn't an accusation. I said, yeah, Mom. She said, I understand. She's a wonderful young woman. She's a beautiful girl. I understand. But you know, it couldn't be. You know that. Because she said the same thing. My mother and she had had a conversation, which is interesting. And she couldn't be, you know
Wow.
that. And I said, she told me that. She said, well, don't worry. I understand. My mother expressed deep compassion with very few words. Her face just expressed deep sympathy and compassion for me at that time. It was a little bit of a heartbreak. And I was very young, of course. It was the first time that I felt that a strong connection with another woman. But it was the ultimate thing was how my mother dealt with it so sweetly. So my mother was tough, but she had these moments of unbelievable tender compassion and understanding. She read me, she understood what was going on inside me. She didn't laugh at it. She didn't mock it. So this is puppy love. No, she didn't make fun of it. She didn't dismiss it. She didn't scold me or anything. It was just beautiful. It was beautiful. So
beautiful.
I cherished it. I cherished, I mean, more than even the thing with the girl, I cherished what happened with between my mother at that moment. So that's the kind of woman my father married. And that is the kind of woman that I would say, if you could see it in a 22 or 23 or 24-year-old girl, guy, that's the kind of woman you want to marry. It's got big heart, but a smart head and tough guts. He's got guts, head, and heart, and can make a home, can cook.
There we go. Yeah, shout out to all the people listening.
And can pray,
Yeah.
Those are some things I would share. But I'm sure there's a lot more to this whole thing of what to look for in a good woman.
How old were your parents when they got married?
Let's see. That my mother, they married in 1933. Because the first son, my oldest brother was born in 1934. Then the second one, 36. I was born 38. So they married in 1933. My mother was born in 1909. She was born 1909. He was born 1907. So he was 26. She was 24.
Oh.
Yeah. 24, 26, 24. Yeah.
That's a great age.
They married without money. He had a job. It was depression, the Great Depression. But he didn't own a car, didn't own a home. So they married a little bit and with risky future. The country was in an economic disarray. They managed. It was a hard life economically. We all had to go out to work at an early age, which I never regretted. We're all meant to be contribute to the common pot. With our hard work at an early, very early age. The boys, not the girls, the boys, just the boys. We all went out to work.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for joining us for yet another episode on the After Cana podcast.
I hope it helps a little bit. I hope.
I'm sure. And make sure to write to us at info@fairestlovefamilyproject.org. If you would like to see more interviews, and if you have any questions for Father Paul, those can be easily forwarded. Thank you so much, Father Paul, and everyone else. Happy listening.
Okie dokie. God bless you.